We made this.
Everyone, to the time is now. Soylent Green is people. I'm your host, Tony Black, and I'm joined for this special episode in which we're going to be talking about the comics of both the X-Files and Millennium, the season 10 comic Immaculate as part of our ongoing series on the X-Cast, and then also as a little bonus, we're going to be talking about the tie-in Millennium five-issue comic from the same author, Joe Harris, that follows up immediately after it, both from 2015. And who else was going to join me for this but Darren Mooney?
I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm thrilled to be talking about these comics as well. Because, again, like, you know, I mean, obviously, there's a larger thing to talk about with all the season 10 stuff. And we're, you know, if you're listening on the X-Files kind of or X-Cast kind of like timeline, it'll be integrated in there. But like, if you're listening on The Time Is Now and getting a sneak peek into the distant future,
It's really fun.
The future, you can't fight it, apparently. I'm thrilled that we're actually getting a chance to talk about like the X-Files season 10 stuff that IDW did, and hopefully some of the other stuff as well. Some of the great stuff, like, you know, Year Zero, and some of the maybe less great stuff, like Conspiracy. But just the whole range of kind of like IDW experience is just fun to talk about. So thank you for having me on.
No, it's a pleasure, Darren. And because we are recording this in the distant mists of time in the past, it wouldn't surprise me if you've also appeared on some of the other IDW comic discussions already. So it could well be that we will give ourselves away here in the fact that we're recording this, you know, in 1956.
But like, I mean, as I was saying last week when we talked about Pilgrims, I had some very strong opinions that I'm sure I still feel right now.
Yeah, well, you will absolutely feel them right now. We're joking, but I bet you'll be on Pilgrims, but we'll see. That's all decisions to come. But what we're going to do, yeah, is talk about what we think about these comics, talk a little bit about their, you know, creation, talk a little bit about the stories involved, and just go through them, as we already have been on the IDW XCast stuff, for those of you listening in the future. Yeah, it's going to be fun because they are very, very interesting, and you've written quite at length, Darren, as you have done with the X-Files and Millennium generally, but you've also written at length about these comics, so it's going to be really good to get your insights into this one, well, into both of them, ultimately. So we'll start with Immaculate then. Now, Immaculate is the 16th and 17th issues of the Season 10 IDW comic of the X-Files, which aired in 2014, I believe, these came out, and written by Joe Harris. And in this episode, this is essentially even though it's a two-part comic, I guess you would be able to think of this as a single episode of The X-Files, if you like, because it's quite a short story, really. And it involves Mulder and Scully going to a small town to investigate what appears to be a simple, harrowing case of a bombing of an abortion clinic. And it seems to be leading a mysterious young woman to be taking control of people and causing lots and lots of deaths. Mulder and Scully investigate and are ultimately assisted by a well-known figure in the form of Frank Black, back from the mists of time himself. So, I mean, should we do what we normally do, Darren, and sort of try and give this a little bit of an out of 10 kind of thing? So, off the top of your head, this, because I know I haven't necessarily super prepared you for this, but what would you say Immaculate is out of 10, and what do you generally think of it as a comic?
Yeah, I mean, like, again, this is one where I'm trying to predict what I've already said about the IDW comics as a whole when I've been on earlier episodes, so let's see how this works. Your move, future Darren. But no, like, generally speaking, and I don't know if this is, like, a view that I hold or a view that is representative of fandom in general, but just personally, I think I've always felt that Joe Harris works better on kind of standalone stories. I think that, like, my favorite issue of the kind of, like, X-Files IDW comic that he wrote was Chitters. And, I mean, I would also argue More Music of a Cigarette Smoking Man as well, because I think they kind of stand alone. I'm less fond of his kind of myth arc stuff. And why that is, we'll probably have a chance to kind of hash out and talk about when we get into that stuff. But this is very much in the spirit of those standalone stories. I know you mentioned that it contains Frank Black, and it's a big kind of... It's very much a backdoor pilot for the Millennium series, the point where, like, I think that the Millennium series was announced the same month that this was released, and obviously, I mean, it has continuity of artist Cullen Lorimer and colorist Joanne LaFonte both carry over from Immaculate into the Millennium series as well, so it was very consciously planned to serve as a springboard to the five issues that we will be talking about later in this episode. But at the same time, it's also, I think you mentioned it, you mentioned there that it feels like a self-contained episode of The X-Files. And it's notable that I think when Audible actually adapted several of these IDW arcs into audio plays with Duchovny, with Anderson, with Mitch Pileggi, and with other actors as well, two issues of comic amounts to about 41 minutes of audio play time. So it is exactly an episode of The X-Files, which is quite neat as well. And it's the kind of X-Files episode that I really like, which is there's something strange and unpleasant happening in a small town, and it's kind of getting at all the gritty and darkness that's lurking beneath the surface. And to its credit, much like I would argue Chitters, again, that single issue story that I absolutely adore and think is Harris's masterpiece, it's also a story that does something interesting in terms of, like, looking at that genre of X-Files story about tensions in a small town and updating it for, you're right, it was published in 2015, but, like, you know, collected and released in 2016, 2017. That feels like it's updating that trope or those conventions to reflect an America that is somewhere different than it was when Mulder and Scully were doing these stories in the 90s. So I really like this story. I would probably give it about a 7 out of 10. And that's only because I'm a very, very harsh marker. But I actually really like these two issues together. And spoiler for what we're about to discuss later on, I actually kind of prefer this to the Millennium series. But we'll talk about that in a moment. I know, well, controversial, now. The hottest of takes.
Well, that is very interesting. And I suppose I was going to ask, I mean, you've been on The Time Is Now talking about the episode of The X-Files, which featured Frank Black, Millennium, in season 7, which is sort of universally derided in many ways. I quite like it, actually, but it's universally derided as not an effective either crossover or conclusion to Frank Black's story. And I think a lot of Millennium fans, or certainly maybe some of the hardcore Millennium fans, prefer things like the Virtual Season 4, say, that came in 1999, which is, you know, fan-made, but it's terrific, you know, and partly endorsed by people like Lance Henriksen and stuff. And so I think this, in a way, is the first... It takes the Millennium episode of The X-Files as canon, obviously, you know, and it features little flashes to elements of that, I suppose, and the whole fact he knows Mulder and stuff. But this, to me, Darren, feels a little bit more like it's leaning towards, and I suppose then the actual comic we'll talk about in a bit, the five-issue one, is maybe more of the crossover slash conclusion to Millennium that we should have had in the first place. This is definitely more of a Millenniumistic Immaculate, certainly. It's a much more Millenniumistic kind of X-File, and you said this in your review, you know, and I would encourage anyone to go and read your review of Immaculate and the subsequent comic after that The X-Files very much was able to inhabit these kind of Millennium stories, and you'd seen that all the way through things like Irresistible and Grotesque all the way up to Millennium. So this feels like it could have been an X-File on screen and could have been quite an effective one, I think.
I mean, but that's the thing, is that I think it finds the sweet spot. And again, Harris very clearly, like, you know, I mean, I'm fairly sure I've said some mean things about Harris in episodes that we've already discussed about his handling of the mythology and stuff like that. But Harris knows this stuff inside and out, and Harris loves this stuff inside and out. It's very evident that he does, and he understands it as well, and he has a fan's eye and kind of like a keen insight into it. And I think what he does with Immaculate, and Immaculate is a much, much, much stronger crossover between the X-Files and Millennium than, ironically, the episode called Millennium. what he understands is he understands, like, the sweet spot of making a story that can work in either universe. And again, like, what you would imagine that would be a serial killer of the week story. As you point out, an episode like Grotesque or Irresistible, you feel like having Frank Black crossover into that would make sense. And it's to Harris's credit that he doesn't do that, because he understands that, like, if you do that, Frank Black becomes the center of gravity. Instead, he takes kind of a step sideways and he says, well, actually, let's do a kind of a small town story with this demonic evil and like religious undertones and like cult-like subtext, which is the kind of thing the X-Files, you know, could do with its eyes closed, the kind of thing Millennium did as well. And like, so, you know, you end up with an episode that feels of a piece with, say, X-Files episodes. I think I mentioned like Genderbender, Red Museum, Our Town, War of the Coprophages, Swisiji, Quagmire, Detour, Roadrunners, and all those. But which also you can imagine airing in a version of Millennium that produced episodes like, say, you know, Covenant from the first season, Broken World from the first season, Beware the Dog in the second, and Nostalgia in the third. The idea of like Frank Black coming to town almost like the cowboy without a gun and having to deal with the fallout of this thing that's happened. And I think like to Harris's credit, he understands that. And it's a very clever way of doing it that manages to avoid the obvious, well, let's just remake Paper Hearts and put Frank Black in it approach, but also works much more consistently, I think, than what actually happened in the episode that was titled Millennium. It's very difficult distinguishing between the episode called Millennium and the TV show called Millennium and the comic called Millennium. So I apologize to listeners who get frustrated when I do that, but that's how I distinguish them.
It's okay. We're big Star Trek fans, and we know the pain of Star Trek, the TV show, Star Trek 09, the movie.
Yeah. And Star Trek, the franchise.
Exactly, yeah. What I find really interesting is that, and this was a conversation we had on the XCast basement not so long back, because I raised the point of how it surprises me how many mega fans of the X-Files have never watched Millennium, or if they have watched Millennium, they found it quite difficult to get into, or they found it quite alienating. And yet these are people who will lap up, like you say, things like Paper Hearts. They will lap up stuff like Grotesque. They will lap up Irresistible, you know. And it's surprising to hear that and that they didn't find... And maybe it's because of the episode Millennium in the seventh season that this is the case partly, but because it wasn't the best Frank Black is or has been as a character... It was not him at his best, as much as Lance Henriksen did as much as he could. You know, Millennium was not...
represented Frank, there. Yeah.
No, Frank fights zombies everywhere. You know, it just wasn't. So.
Well, I mean, I want to be careful here because I don't want to say... Like, this is the kind of thing where I say it and I'm going to sound like the most pretentious, unimaginable asshole ever. I don't mean this in a pretentious sort of way. I think The X-Files is... far, far, far more accessible than Millennium is.
Yeah,
and I don't mean that as a to disparage or belittle either of those. In that, like, I think you're right. You like X-Files fans can watch episodes like Irresistible or Grotesque, and like that, you know, and that's a different experience than sitting down and watching Millennium. And it's a different experience because like you jump from episodes like Irresistible through to, you know, like Our Town, or like from Grotesque into Swisiji, and you just have this kind of like wider range of palette. And like if it's very dark and oppressive this week, maybe next week it will be a bit lighter, a bit goofy, or a bit more playful, a bit more schlocky. Whereas with Millennium, and like I love Millennium from the bottom of my heart, and like again, this is where Darren manages to alienate everybody. Like my favorite stretch of 10-13 is the season and a half from midway through the first season of Millennium. Once you hit, I think it's the Thin White Line and Force Majeure. When you follow from that straight through to like the Fourth Horseman and The Time Is Now, that's my like gold stretch of kind of like gold streak of Millennium, or sorry, of 10-13 as a television production house. I don't think there's a stretch that long in The X-Files that is that good, as controversial as that sounds. But I also understand that like asking audiences to get in on that is oppressive and dark and it weighs you down and it's not fun. And like, I don't mean to disparage fun. I'm not saying it's better or anything like that. I'm just saying that I understand why, if you're sitting down watching Millennium after 8 straight episodes of pasty, balding white guy does terrible, terrible things, you're like, okay, fine, tap me out. Like, again, when I talked about this in the Time Is Now, and I shouldn't go into it in too much depth again, but, like, when I was reviewing The X-Files of Millennium, I would find that, like, I could binge-watch The X-Files. I could watch 4-8 episodes of, like, The X-Files in pretty much one sitting, and then kind of parse out a bunch of reviews about them. If I tried to do that with Millennium, I had trouble sleeping that night. And, like, I don't scare easy. It wasn't like I was staring at the shadows. It was just, like, I'd wake up sweaty and I wouldn't know why. And the only thing I could do is figure out, this stuff has been bouncing around inside my head. So, no, I get Millennium not being everybody's cup of tea, to be entirely fair.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, that's absolutely fine, you know? But I always think, I think you've summed up in many ways the reasons why that's probably the case, you know, and there's lots of other things you can get into the whole of the discussion, really, about, you know, the appeal of the characters.
Yeah,
no, I'm not saying that as a criticism to you. It's just there is so much there to talk about in terms of the characters and what people watch these shows for. But I find it very interesting when you get a comic like Immaculate, and obviously comics, it's a different kind of form. You haven't got the relationship with a comic that you do with the TV show in the same, you're not receiving that in the same way, you know, it's not written in quite the same way, it's not presented in quite the same way. But I just find it very interesting what readers of this comic, and let's face it, the readers of these comics are probably going to be fairly hardcore deep dive X-Files fans, realistically, people who go and seek out that material. Are they, I wonder, going to be people who also love Millennium or watch Millennium and who will receive Frank? Because it does sort of put Frank back in there with the assumption you probably know who he is, generally, that you've got an idea of who he is, who the Millennium Group are, and even though he is focused, certainly, especially part one as well, because Frank is the sort of the cliffhanger moment of part one, isn't he, in him appearing.
He's not actually, like, which I find interesting. Like, the cliffhanger of part one isn't Frank. It's Frank is the teaser of part two.
Oh,
which I kind of love.
Yeah, you're
like,
right.
Like,
yeah.
Again, we'll talk about how cleverly it's structured. But, like, and again, like, credit to Harris and to his artist as well. He paces these things so they're like TV episodes. So, like, the splash page with the little X-Files logo down the bottom is like, this is the end of your teaser. We now go to the theme song. And, like, in part two, that moment is Frank Black, and then we just get the X-Files kind of theme going on. And he does it in the Millennium issues as well, where you'll have the splash page, and then down the bottom you'll have, like, the kind of like a widescreen panel with the Millennium Ouroboros effect and the quote, which, again, is a nice formal nod. It's like, you're right, comics are different than TV or film, but I love that Harris actually makes an effort to say, yeah, but I'm still going to structure my 20 or 30 episode, 30 page comic so that it resembles the form that I'm mimicking, which I thought was quite nice.
Yeah, definitely, yeah, in that you feel like you could be cutting to credits, absolutely, is that whole idea. And that's it. It allows you to, you know, try and think of it in terms of a TV episode, and I suppose it would be, if this was a 40-minute episode, Frank might appear roughly halfway in and then be in more of the second half. But I just always find it interesting how people might engage with Frank in a story like this, you know, and whether or not, because he's different in the actual, you know, the Millennium comic, which we'll talk about in a bit. But in this, Frank is coming into a Mulder and Scully investigation. Yet it is also a story that, as we've talked about, is very much designed to be a Millennium style episode of the X-Files. So it's, they're two worlds which, and it goes back, I suppose, to the idea that Millennium retrospectively sort of backed into becoming an X-Files spin-off as opposed to being devised as, you know, lots of interconnectivity. You know, that's not, had all these things been made 20 years later, they would have been thought of much more in those sort of terms that we used to now. I think Harris does a very good job of porting all of this over with a level of assumption that you know who Frank is, that the audience reading this will get it, but also, you know, like you say, nicely sort of teasing the comic to come, you know, the actual Millennium comic to come, but without it being that Frank takes over an X-Files story. So I think the balance in Immaculate is well done there.
Would you say it's immaculately done?
Oh, well, One of us had to do it, didn't we? And it was bound to be you.
It was statistically bound to be. Like, I think actually to bring it back to something you're saying there, which I think is very important, is basically to acknowledge, like, Millennium was retrofitted in some ways to being an X-Files spin-off. In that, like, I think when Carter said it, when Carter launched the show, he didn't want to rely on things like crossovers to boost success. You know, there was like little homages, like I think in Lamentation, when Frank is visiting FBI headquarters, you can see the stand-ins for Duchovny and Anderson in the background, for example, and obviously things get more overt as they go on, like Jose Chung pops up in the second season in Doomsday Defense, which if you're gonna watch an episode of Millennium, that's the one to watch. Yeah. But even things like, say, you know, like even like as it gets on, you have things like the cigarette smoking man implied to be a member of the Millennium group and things like that, and it kind of like accrues continuity as it goes. But you're right that like this was a product of television in the 90s, and even say the Star Trek shows in the 90s didn't have too much interlocking connectivity between shows that were ostensibly happening at the same time. So like Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. Occasionally Worf would pop over to Deep Space Nine for an episode, or the Cardassians would do something in The Next Generation that they'd reference in Deep Space Nine. But by and large, those three stores, universes, basically were self-contained and occasionally only interlocking. And it's kind of interesting that, like, you mentioned the shared universe that we would have now, today, which is largely a result of, like, the success of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which draws from comics, because comics do this stuff. And you mentioned like the big formal difference between television and comics, and you're right in that, like, this assumes a level of familiarity with Frank, but that's not even it. It's, if you're watching a TV show, your attention has to be on the screen. You have to be watching the screen constantly throughout. You cannot control the pace of your movement through the story. That's just how the medium works. They show you images, they play sounds, and you have to absorb them as they're thrown at you. And you don't have a chance to stop and go, hey, but wait, what if... Whereas if you're getting a comic... Yes, a lot of the panel layout controls your pacing and rhythm of the story. And a lot of really good artists are very good with panel layouts at controlling your movement through a page without you even realizing they're doing it. But if you are reading a comic and you see something that you don't recognize, you can literally stop on that panel and go to Google and search, who is Frank Black? Who is the Millennium Group? Who is Jordan? And it encourages this kind of level of kind of interlocking continuity. And, you know, again, like, for listeners listening on the XCast line, we've already talked about how Carter kind of eventually embraced the idea of kind of spin-offs and crossovers, like, with The Lone Gunman, which was, like, the third big spin-off, or the third big kind of, like, 10-13 non-X-Files shows. So it was, you know, Millennium, Harsh Realm, and then with The Lone Gunman, Carter seemed to, like, throw his hands up in the air and say, fine, I can't launch a show that isn't related to the X-Files or a satellite state of the X-Files. I will just launch the most obvious spin-off of the X-Files, and Skinner's going to be there, and Mulder's going to cameo in it, and look, you guys got what you wanted, Fox, and you still cancelled it after, what, 13 episodes? But, like, still, like, what you see with the management of IDW, when IDW get the license for the X-Files, you get a much more comic booky universe where things are integrated and connected. So, like, for example, you have the spin-off series Conspiracy, in which the Lone Gunman cross over with all of the other IDW properties, like, say, you know, Transformers, or say the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that sort of stuff. And here you have, like, the using of this as a launching pad into Frank Black getting his own 5-issue miniseries as well, and the way in which it's clearly designed as such, because I think Harris has said, like, when IDW launched season 10, it performed really well. And, you know, you're right, we should acknowledge that, like, really well for a comic is tiny compared to literally anything else, but it performed really well in terms of being a comic from a publisher that was not DC or was not Marvel. I think it was consistently in the top 200 books in a given month. It was selling somewhere in the region, I think, between 10 and 12,000 issues, you know, on a regular basis, which is quite good given the state of the market. So, like, IDW looked at this and they said, well, look, the X-Files is selling well. There's a fan base that are buying these books. What other properties do we have that are X-Files adjacent and we can work in? And kind of Millennium became a package deal of that. And so it is very much like how you expect comic books to be structured. Like, if you go back and you read Amazing Fantasy or the originals, like Spider-Man, the original Spider-Man comics, like, in the very first issue, Spider-Man tries to join the Fantastic Four because they're part of the same universe and that's part of the attraction. And the idea, you know, if you read comic books and you read like any new hero that appears in their first year, I guarantee you that they will have a crossover with either Spider-Man or Wolverine if they're in Marvel, or they will have a crossover with Batman, Superman, or the Joker if they're at DC, because people follow characters across books. And the idea is, if you want people to get your an eye on your book, you put the character in there. So you, I like the Immaculate and the Millennium miniseries, which we'll talk about in a moment, are structured as comic books, where it's like Frank Black is a character wandering into an X-Files story and hoping that the audience will wander out with him. And then you get the trade-off in the Millennium book of like Mulder being there. And again, we'll talk about it when we talk about the 5-issue miniseries. Mulder not really having any reason to be there outside the fact that maybe if Mulder's there, a couple of X-Files fans will follow over and join us on this Millennium party that we're on together, you know?
It's more, definitely more expressly designed. You're absolutely right, you know, in order to have these overlapping aspects. But I think what I like about Immaculate is that it is very much it's a contained yet open-ended story. Isn't it really? You know, it has a lot of these different strands to it in terms of small town Americana, in terms of the abortion debate, in terms of, you know, religious influences, you know, potential sex abuse. You know, there's lots and lots of things going around there which call back to potentially lots of other different Millennium episodes as well, and very much fits in that wheelhouse. But it's, and even though it's in a way it's quite decidedly open-ended, as befits many an X-Files episode, thematically it's got a lot in this that sort of carries then on into the Millennium 5-issue series, and as you say, establishes Frank as this, you know, quite disaffected, jaded man who is just a bit lost in the world, you know, as you'd expect Frank to be in many ways in this paradigm, you know, so far after the Millennium. But I mean, yeah, I think Immaculate, with this story about this young girl who sort of bombs an abortion clinic, you know, pretends to be pregnant, bombs an abortion clinic, and then starts to, if not possess people, then certainly, you know, create a whole group of followers behind her who then start dying in lots of horrible ways. It has definite traits
and killing
of
an, in horrible and, ways as well.
And killing. It has definite traits of the X-Files' paranormality, but it also has the Millennium's darkness, Millennium's, you know, intensity. But I think what it does well, and I think what Harris does well, is combine the two in a way that we didn't get, obviously, in the Millennium episode in Season 7, but combine the two in the, let's face it, Legion and the demonic aspect of Millennium has always been very, very X-Files in terms of the fact it's clearly paranormal. It's clearly, you know, it's clearly something that Mulder and Scully have in a way investigated sometimes in certain different ways. You know, you almost feel like that Mulder and Scully have faced Legion when they've faced Donnie Faster. You know, people, characters like that, you know, what's she called from Diane Dovellet? I'm blanking on the name. The school teacher, Mrs. Oh, you know what I mean. Fans are going to cursing me now, aren't they? Because I should know this.
Well, I mean, it's been years since you recorded that episode. I mean, I don't even know
Mrs.
how
Paddock.
Long it's been.
Mrs. Paddock. Yes. There we go. It has been years, Darren. I think that was, when was that? 2016? Christ.
Jesus, that's like 10 years ago now.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Wow. But yeah, so, and you know, I'm 5 years older, guys, and my memory is not what it was. But yeah, it definitely, I feel like they all share a kind of universe. So I think in some ways, without it being too explicit. So I think it does that combination of these demonological aspects with the X-Files paranormality very well in this story.
Yeah, and I mean, like, to its credit, like, we talked a lot about it, like, as a crossover, it feeling like an X-Files, feeling like a Millennium episode. It is a well-told story in its own right, which I think it, like, deserves acknowledgement for, because we are talking about it as a crossover, we are talking about, like, Frank Black, we are talking about Mulder and Scully. It is, in its own way, a fascinating story, and it's a story that plays with these tropes and conventions that you expect from both the X-Files and Millennium. Like, you mentioned that you have this idea of kind of like followers, and this idea of like a young girl who got pregnant, who had an abortion, and then who went back a month later and blew up the kind of abortion clinic where she'd had it. But in like bringing these followers together, dividing this town, and Mulder and Scully doing an investigation that ultimately, you know, unveils that the father of the child was implicitly the local minister, which again is one of those themes that you see come come up time and time again in, like, X-Files stories and in sort of, like, Millennium stories. Stories like, say, The Well-Worn Lock, for example. Stories like that. And, like, to Harris's credit, it's not just that it's like, oh, he obviously knows the continuity and the history and he makes all the right references. It's that he understands, like, the larger framework. Like, there's a really striking panel. And again, shout out to, I think it's Colin Lorimer, the artist, and Joanne LaFuente, the colorist. But, like, that sequence where Mulder's wandering through the trailer park and he finds the tree with all the dangling crosses on it, which looks like something from out of True Detective, which is exactly what the X-Files should kind of feel like. Like in 2015, it should have that kind of like eerie, otherworldly, uncanny quality to it. So, like, I mean, even outside of like the Millennium continuity, even outside the Legion stuff, even outside of all that, I think that like Immaculate works very well as an X-Files story and as a story about this small community and about like what's happening beneath the surface and how that boils to the surface in ways that are, you know, uncomfortable, uncanny, and cause these kind of nightmares. So I think like it deserves credit in those terms at least as well.
Well, you said something in your review. You went much more in depth on this, and it was very interesting actually, because you said and you wrote, you would have written that review a few years ago now from even where we record. So goodness knows from when people are listening. But even then, you saw that there was something a little bit prophetic in what Joe Harris was talking about. Really, that there's this underbelly of anger within Middle America that has turned it into a very nightmarish place. And, you know, you say as much in terms of the True Detective sort of style of this, and that's exactly what, you're right, that's exactly what the X-Files should be in this modern day. Have that level, and what Millennium would be if it was ever brought back, and have that level of, that we don't really understand what this has become, you know. And then this ties into politics and it ties into culture. And there's a lot of people in different paradigms and different sides of the culture wars and the religious debates and everything going on right now that fundamentally don't seem to understand either other sides of these things or particularly what communities have become. I think in certain parts of the West, and I think this in its own way sort of nods towards where that was going.
Well, I mean, like, not to put too fine a point on it, but like there's a sequence in this where half of a town turns and murders the other half of the town, and like, you know, like the half murdering are kind of like colored in red and the half murdered are colored in blue and stuff like that, and it's not like subtle about it at all. And like it's like, this is what I talked about when I talked about like one of the things that I think Harris does really, really well in the standalones, and I think it's like, you know, I've talked hopefully to you about some of my problems with mythology. My problem with the mythology stuff is that it's almost the opposite of this. But in the standalones, he takes those templates of like those 90s X-Files where Mulder and Scully go to a small town and they discover something unusual or uncomfortable there, and there's a sense of encroaching modernity. Think of like Home as the archetypal example here, where like there's this real fear that like all these shadowy places are just kind of shrinking away and we'll all be connected and we'll all be the same eventually. And like Harris says, okay, actually we're 20 years later and that is not what happened at all. What happened at all is instead that we are more divided than ever, we are angrier than ever, we are less understanding of one another than ever before. And like there's a wonderful thing where Frank like tells Mulder, and it's a wonderful line where Frank explains what's happening in this town. And when I say he explains what's happening in this town, it's more he explains what isn't happening in this town, and therefore you can infer what's happening in this town, where he says, like, this isn't about abortion or religious politics or any other tangible issue. It's about something ineffable. It's about something that is hard to quantify or hard to measure. And I like that Harris understands that it's kind of something moving beneath the surface that is hard to explain and hard to quantify, because it's not as simple as saying it is about abortion rights or it is about religious politics. It's a more fundamental divide. It's a cultural divide that's kind of happened, or a cultural schism that's happened, and the way in which it seems like either side is incapable of understanding the other. Like, the truth, again, the truth is out there, but the truth is fundamentally unknowable in some senses. And, like, again, it's something that I really love in Chitters. And again, you know, sorry to keep mentioning Chitters when I'm like, Immaculate is good. I like Immaculate, but Chitters is where it's really at. But it's something that Harris comes back to time and time again. And it's something I really like in like the season 10 comics as a whole. And I think it's here. And I think it's a really great way to do like Frank Black and, you know, Mulder and Scully, and like to bring them together and say, this is where America is. And like, you know, you joke about my review being prophetic because I wrote it back, I think, in June 2016. And there's a really like pithy paragraph where I'm like, yeah, Ted Cruz was appealing to small town and rural voters, demonstrating his willingness to stand up to those big city elites. And it's like, Darren, you were so naive in June 2016. You had no idea what was actually coming. But yeah, no, like, but Harris does deserve credit because like, I don't think I'm reading into that. I don't think I'm picking that up and like inventing it out of thin air. I think that's there. And I think Harris put it there. And I think Harris, you know, again, to say that he understood it or we understand it or anything like that, but to be cognizant of it or aware of it and understand that, again, this is rife fodder for the X-Files and Millennium, because it is in its own way a kind of horror that we don't understand. It's something that is unsettling and uncanny and uncomfortable. And, you know, I mean, yeah, again, not to get too political or anything like that, like in 2016, there were several times where I woke up and was like, I don't understand the world that we're in right now. I don't think I get why things happened that have just happened, you know? And obviously that's because I was wrong and out of touch. Like, I'm not insinuating that those things didn't happen for reasons. I'm saying I didn't understand personally, you know?
Well, same. And I think a lot of people listening may well feel the same, you know, in that they, or those who do understand were surprised that things happened either way. And I think, you know, I think Joe Harris definitely felt that way himself. I mean, if you, and I'm sure we've talked about this before, you know, on the IDW explorations we've done already in the future. But and we'll talk about it again, because particularly when he does the continuation comics later on after the series, he gets extremely pretty. Yeah. He just doubles down then. He just goes for it.
Which and is he, great. Like, I love that.
Yeah, he just doesn't care.
Because the X-Files should be. Because, like, the X-Files is. Like, there's no way to separate the X-Files from where America is at that moment in time. Because the X-Files is America. Not to get too political, but, you know.
No, it's definitely there. You know, he would, I'm sure, and, you know, he's been on the X-Cast in the past. And I'm sure we did talk about this. And, you know, he is definitely that kind of writer. So I think he's coding a lot of these things. But it is something, like you say, it's ineffable. It's something in the air. I mean, Joni says the same thing, doesn't she? Joni Cartwright, the girl. She says, they think this is about small things, like a clash of values or political disagreements. But it's more than all that. And I know you know what I mean. And I mean, that is it. That's the same thing Frank is sort of getting at. There is something changing. There's something in the air. There's something dark. There's something creeping in. In terms of where we are, and framing it within this idea of this evil, this corrupting evil that is now getting a foothold, is great, and it really does work in this. It leaves it open ended at the end in some senses, but it sets the stage for the comic to come. Even though, you know, Scully isn't part of that story, and Mulder is. Still a fairly ancillary part of what's to come. So this is very much Frank's reintroduction back into a world that the actual Millennium comic explores in greater detail. But like you say, it still works. It still works on its own terms, and I think that's why it's a really good piece of work. Should we talk about the comic then? Should we use that as a launch pad to talk about the actual 5-issue comic then from Millennium?
Yes, we should talk about Millennium, the comic. Millennium. We should at some point talk about it. I love Immaculate so much, but yes, we should talk about Millennium.
It's great. It's a great comic, and it's a very good one. And it does lead nicely into the actual 5-part Millennium story, which came a little bit later, didn't it? It came.
I launched, I think, January 2016. I want to say.
Yeah. Something along those lines.
The first January 2015. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. And it obviously focuses on Frank, but Mulder is in this story as well. I mean, to sort of describe this would probably take a bit of time. It essentially brings everything back into the pot. It brings back the Millennium Group, it brings back Lucy Butler, it brings back Legion, it brings back Jordan. We see flashes of Catherine, We even see Y2K. You know, we go back right to the
and
millennium.
And the Twin Towers, implicitly.
And the
as
Twin
well, yeah.
Towers. And, you know, the
Yellow
they
House
all
pops up. And, like, they've the implicitly house. Repainted. They've repainted the Yellow House as yellow again, apparently.
Yep.
somewhere between The Sound of Snow and this point in the kind of history and continuity.
Everything's in here. This is what I actually love, because it is the instigating thing in issue one. Monty Props. Now,
in a Millennium comic, which is the best,
could you even have imagined it, Darren? Like, I mean, Monty Props is one of the, before this, would have been one of the great unknown lost X-Files stories ever. Because Monty Props was the serial killer that Mulder helped catch.
The monograph,
in like the late 1980s, and he wrote a monograph on it. And Scully mentions it right at the very beginning of the X-Files. So, and then that's it. You never hear of Monty Props again. And that's always a big, like, what? Who was Monty Props? He sounds like... I always think of Greg Proops from Whose Line Is It Anyway when I hear that name. I always think he's like a comedian, like, you know, oh, it's Monty Props.
And I mean, but, like, it's notable, I think, that Harris has said, like, that was on his X-Files bucket list. And the story of how Mulder bought the I Want to Believe poster from a head shop. And I think it's notable, I think, that, like, in the space that he was publishing this, because, again, this was, like, early 2015, there were already rumors that the X-Files were coming back to television. I think that, at this sense, like, Harris was aware of the fact that he maybe wasn't going to get to play in the sandbox forever because, again, Carter was going to take back the keys. And, again, when we're, you know, like, you can just listen to the other episodes of the X-Cast where we talk about the IDW run and get a bigger sense of that. But there's a real sense of, like, this has been on my X-Files fan bucket list, so it's going in here. Because I think that, like, G23, is that the story arc? Where, like, it was published simultaneously with this, and that's the one where Harris says, yep, this is also the origin story of the I Want to Believe poster, because I'm in control of the franchise and I'm going to do whatever I want while I can. And, like, the thing about the Monty Props thing, which is so absurd, is they bring Monty Props back and then they kill him off by the end of the issue, which is kind of, adore that in terms of, like, fanishness. It's like, yep, great. I've solved that problem, wipe my hands clean, now let's get on with the rest of the story.
Yeah, brilliant, isn't it? And because it's almost a bit of a, for me, it reminded me of Tombs, when Mulder basically is saying, don't let this guy out, like, and they're saying, oh, well, no, he's a model citizen now, he won't go out and kill again, and Mulder's like, surely he will, you know? But then that's it, Harris subverts it by... You know, by having him die and having him be connected to the Millennium Group. I think that kind of thing is a stroke of genius, because I think it actually connects these two in a far more logical and, yeah, very deep cut way than the show itself would have either done or been able to do. I mean, and that's the thing with this comic. You know, it brews all of these things together. It sort of builds to the logical... You know, throw everything into the pot. Final frank sort of confrontation with Lucy Butler and Legion and Jordan and well, yeah. But all of these things, it sort of gives you what would be the ultimate Millennium story. You know, almost like a Millennium movie would do, or you know, a big fun. So it's very much sort of almost like a blockbuster sort of Millennium story, but at the same time, It's a kind of thing that I don't think you would ever have been able to have produced in this way on television. You know, like,
can you imagine telling Fox you wanted to do this? Like, and they'd be like, Jesus Christ, no!
Yeah.
Can't you just go back and do, like, singles, like Stories of the Week and stuff like that? What are you trying to do? You want to put the Twin Towers in the opening episode? No, you can't! Get out of here! No, it's definitely not. It's something that is very suited to the medium of comics, because comics are, as you noted, traditionally seen as ancillary media. Like, they're secondary, they're allowed to be nerdy, they're allowed to be, like, deep cut continuity references and stuff like that. And, like, since we're talking about it now, I guess I'll kind of let my kind of, like, beef with the Millennium miniseries, which I like quite a bit, to be fair. I think there's a lot to recommend it. I think it's ambitious, I think it's clever, I think that Harris does a really good job with what is frankly an impossible brief of trying to, like, reconcile the three different shows that Millennium was when it was on the air into a single narrative. And I think he deserves a great deal of credit for that. But I also find myself a little frustrated because I read it and it looks like a pilot. It reads like Harris is saying, this is not the end of Millennium. I'm not doing like a wrap-up miniseries. I'm doing a launchpad into a companion series to be published alongside the X-Files.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I get
but
that.
But oops,
I can see
they're both being cancelled now. I'm going to get like eight issues to wrap up like X-Files season 11 because that's coming back to television. But yeah, no, this stuff is done. And it feels like it's kind of warming up. Like, it introduces this wonderful status quo. It like hints at all this stuff that has happened in the interim between the end of Millennium and this. And you can really see, like, you get a sense reading it that like there's a Bible for this, and the Bible is great. And it's like, this could run for like 25 issues. Like again, this could be Millennium season 4 in IDW, and it would probably end somewhere spectacular. But like, reading it, I constantly feel like I'm getting teases for something that is never going to pay off. And I know that's not necessarily like a fair criticism of Harris. Like, I know that, like, when you're writing comics, you never end anything because you want to be able to continue to publish. And I know that, like, if the miniseries had sold well, it sold, I think it started out relatively strongly and then just kind of dropped off the radar. I don't have any figures for anything past the second issue, which was selling somewhere around, I think, 6,000 copies, which was about half of what the X-Files was doing. So I imagine that trajectory kind of continued along those lines. But, like, I kind of read it and it's like, I would love to read the monthly series that this became. Sort of like, you know, like, and again, for people who are not familiar with comics, that's how a lot of stuff happens in comics. People will write a 4-issue miniseries. It will sell really well and it'll get turned into a monthly. Like, I think Grant Morrison's Animal Man, which is one of like my favorite comic books ever, was like Grant Morrison goofing round on a character that nobody cared about for 4 issues. And then they realized it was selling. So they're like, damn, we need 21 more issues of this, Grant. And they're like, yeah, sure, I'm on it, like a whatever with a Scottish accent. But yeah, no, that's my big issue with Millennium, is my big issue with the IDW miniseries Millennium, is that like it feels like a start rather than an end, and it's kind of almost more frustrating for that, because it's like, this is somehow even less resolved than the show was. I just want an ending.
That's interesting. To be honest, now you're saying it, now you're framing it like that, I can see it, actually. Because I did come out of it feeling like it could work as an ending. And a bit of a teasing sort of, you know, wink ending where, you know, Lucy Butler becomes, you know, Samantha from Bewitched and does a little, turns into a little, you know, I'll be seeing you, Frank, wink. So, you know, a little bit of a suggestion that it never ends, you know, and like she sort of says at the end, I'll be back in a thousand years and there'll be another Frank Black, or, you know, all that stuff, which is fine. So I can see it on that context, but I totally see where you're coming from, because it does establish, it does put in place things, doesn't it? You know, it establishes that Jordan's older and has sort of been a bit corrupted by the Millennium Group, so you'd imagine that potentially she would end up hewing back closer to Frank, you know, as she really sort of discovers her these powers, these sort of angelic sort of uber Lara Means kind of powers that she's got going on, you know, and so she might start working. I mean, you'd imagine in a series, wouldn't you, that she would end up going with Frank and they'd go off and they'd investigate things together potentially.
She'd be the Emma Hollis character. Yeah. Notably, like, there are several omissions here. And again, like, I don't blame Harris, because, like, trying to wrap up everything in Millennium is completely insane and impossible to do. And again, the idea that you're aiming for a broad audience here, as much as a broad audience exists in comic books, but you're aiming for people who maybe haven't seen, again, like, I think when we covered like the third season of Millennium on, you know, The Time Is Now, we were looking at like hundreds of people voting for episodes on IMDb, you know, lucky to hit 200, 300 max, that sort of stuff. So like, you know, I understand why, you know, Emma Hollis isn't here, for example, but I also kind of, you know, wonder, you know, is there a place for Emma Hollis here? Could he have worked that in as well? And it does feel like the way that it's set up, it does feel like a pilot where it's like, okay, Jordan has been corrupted. And you see Jordan basically murdering somebody effectively. And again, you know, it's deliberately ambiguous, and it's, you know, it's, she picks her victim very carefully and she doesn't actually kill him and stuff like that, but she's initiated into the group and she's, her hands are literally bloody, there's blood on her hands, even if it's her own ultimately, and so you have this kind of idea that the setup you're getting is, can Frank save Jordan? And again, to the credit of Harris as a writer, one of the little touches I really like is that he differentiates Frank's and Jordan's gift. And again, shout out to the artist Colin Lorimer and the colorist Joanne LaFente, because they distinguish the visions very well. That you get these kind of like strong black and white kind of like heavily inked images with like vibrant reds for Frank and like light blues for Jordan. But you get this differentiation that like Frank's vision shows what happened and Jordan's vision shows what might happen. And you get a real sense reading the comic that it's like, oh yeah, this is going to be. It's going to be the two of them teaming up and maybe reconciling their differences and maybe Frank trying to save Jordan's soul and reconnect with her. Except by the time that's set up, that dynamic is set up, it's like, oops, it's over.
It's over. So it does. I can see what you mean. It does feel like that has room to continue and room to grow, because obviously Jordan doesn't come into it until a couple of three issues in. And so there is more room for that. And the Millennium Group itself is established again as the group. You know, I mean, there's a line the line that made me chuckle was where they said, This is the worst schism since 1997, you know, which is a reference to the Owls and Roosters stuff. And, you know, so it's that aware of itself. I mean, they for all the world look like the Syndicate. You know, it's a bunch of men sitting around a table. So, you know, Harris is essentially establishing the Millennium Group once again, whereas, you know, by the time of the season 7 episode, they were essentially a bunch of weirdos bringing back some zombies. You know, that was it. You know,
like, not only that, like, again, Harris does really, really great work here. Like, Harris also is just as playful as the show was. So, like, again, like, in the second season finale of Millennium, In the Time Is Now, Peter Watts goes to a Millennium facility and he finds a pack of Morleys on the ground. And from that, you're meant to infer, oh, the cigarette-smoking man is also a member of the Millennium Group. But, like, throughout this miniseries, there's recurring shots of, like, characters shot in silhouette, but with their glasses, like, shining and reflecting. And if you're reading X-Files season 10 alongside this, and apologies to listeners who are like reading in real time or listening in real time, but you will know that that is Gibson praise, or that's how the comics depict Gibson praise. So you could, if you wanted, infer that maybe Gibson praise, as well as resurrecting the Syndicate in the X-Files season 10, is also a member of the revived Millennium Group, which again feels like an extension of the cigarette smoking man being part of both groups as well. Like, it's very clever. It's, again, Snake eats his own tail, appropriately enough in terms of iconography, but as a sense, like Immaculate, as a sense, Harris knows what he's doing. And, like, again, to, you know, I've been rather harsh on the miniseries at this point, I will say something I absolutely adore, which I think is very clever: the way in which Jordan defeats Lucy at the end, which, again, she, throughout the comic, you have this recurring motif of, like, scattered imagery and this idea of kind of like patterns that are random and kind of like lines that seem to bend, and there's no real way to connect the dots or whatever. And Jordan then at the climax manages to bring them together to form the Ouroboros, the circle, and trap Lucy within the circle. And that feels to me, and again, I don't think I'm giving, like, Harris too much credit here. I think Harris has earned the credit I'm about to give him. But it feels to me like Harris is literalizing the process of writing a comic like this, where, and we've talked about this on The Time Is Now repeatedly, like, where Millennium is three different shows, where Millennium changes direction dramatically between seasons because showrunners change, where character motivations shift, where mythology just jumps randomly in directions that you can't control, where things that you saw happen, you are told later did not happen. And, like, Harris, as writing this comic, has to try and fit all those elements together. And I like the metatextual idea of Jordan taking all these wavy lines, these strange patterns which don't seem to link up, and kind of suturing them together into a circle where everything is made whole. And that's how you defeat Lucy Butler. That's how you trap the demon at the heart of Millennium. I actually really like that as a narrative trick within the story. The idea that Jordan is stitching together these pictures in the same way that Harris is stitching together this mythology. So, like, I do think, like, again, Harris does really good work here that I do appreciate, despite my earlier criticisms of the story, which I think are still fair.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's perfect by any means. I think it's got a lot of things in there that are almost sort of fan-pleasing. I mean, having, like, Lucy Butler and Mulder like have scenes together is just blows your geek mind. I mean, God knows what, if Kurt North is reading this, God knows what's going to happen to him in that moment, because he's going to lose his mind.
And having that scene together as well, which is like, there's no reason for that scene to exist apart from like a room with a view is a thing that happened. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, we're doing that with Mulder. And also we're getting a reference to Bob Bletcher in there as well. It is very continuity heavy. Like, to be fair, and again, part of me is like, it's when is too much when I read these things? But part of me is also like, you know what? He's put the work in and there's enough going on underneath it that I can kind of excuse it. Like, there's this recurring motif that you have through the series with the suggestion. You mentioned it kind of earlier on. It's worth coming back to the idea that, like, the millennium passed and whether or not anything happened. And, like, again, Harris, like, has this push and pull between the two ideas, which I think is very clever. And I think it's something you could only do with Millennium. You can't do it with The X-Files. Because with The X-Files, like, the time is, like, you know, 2012. And it's an alien invasion. There's really no wiggle room there. Whereas the way in which, like, Millennium as a TV show was written, it's like, nobody actually knows what's going to happen when the Millennium hits. Nobody actually knows when that thing that might possibly happen is going to happen when the Millennium hits. So you get this, like, inference in the first episode that, like, and again, it's that old, I think it was Wolf Blitzer who said, like, the 21st century began on September 11th. But you have that shot of the two Millennium Group members against the Twin Towers, like, waiting for the countdown to the new millennium. And you have Harris insinuating then, well, actually, maybe the millennium change that happened, you know, didn't happen on the 1st of January 2001 or 2000. It happened on 11 September. And that literally changed the world and the way the world worked. But you also have this tension throughout of things like the graffiti saying, instead of the time is now, the time has passed as well. And this kind of idea of, like, what happens after the millennium, which is a very clever hook for a story like this. And for something that, again, Millennium was kind of working on. Like, again, to the miniseries credit, it bites off a lot.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. And I suppose looking at that, it ties into Immaculate in the sense of that if the time has passed, and at one point Frank, you know, does the Soylent Greenies people and he logs back in and that kind of thing, and it says something like 5,100 days have passed.
Since the millennium. Yeah.
Since the millennium. And, I mean, I think that was something that, you know, even though we wrote these before this miniseries, when we did Virtual Season 5, I'm sure we did something similar. I'm sure we actually had Frank log in and, you know. So it's definitely something you do when you write Millennium sort of stories. But it almost suggests that, you know, the whole episode, what I like about this miniseries is that it sort of places Frank in this very sort of dark alien world that it is hard to really understand now. You know, it's almost like, you know, when the millennium was coming, even though, as we say, there was no fixed date, there was no specific time, everyone sort of understood that the 31st of December or the 1st of January or whatever was a moment, was something to build towards. And it was almost like this tangible thing that you could understand that there was something going to happen, this great battle, this apocalypse. But now we're in a sort of lawless land. We're in a land where we don't know what's going to happen next. You know, and as the last few years have proven quite rightly, just as this comic came out, in fact, which again suggests that prophetic nature, and that Frank is this, you know, lost, this Ronin from a bygone age, this lost man trying to understand his place, and the evil is still out there. If anything, the evil's growing and taunting him, you know, and corrupting, potentially helping to corrupt his daughter and corrupting these young women who are, you know, like we saw in Immaculate with Joni. Just this whole idea that Frank is completely lost, and it's terrifying. It's terrifying to him. I mean, what really stood out for me, and I think this was what was great about the artwork, was how well his visions were encapsulated in these comic strips for both of these stories. This nightmarish rush of fiery sort of imagery in his head, where he's even seeing, like, Catherine saying, "Come to me, Frank," and all this kind of thing. And I loved that whole part of it where he's going to a grave in, like, the dark, rainy night. It's just so evocative. And then also when he goes to the ruined yellow house, I loved that. I thought that was wonderful. In fact, it reminded me of something which obviously came out after this, but Danny Torrance going to the Overlook in Doctor Sleep.
In Doctor Sleep, yeah.
Which I love that whole sequence where he goes to the Overlook and he's going back, you know, to where it's a similar kind of idea of somebody returning to this ghost, this haunted house almost, this ghostly sort of place that's full of the past, you know, alive in a sense. And it makes total sort of thematic sense that that would be where the ending happens. I just think it's got a lot of great ideas. I mean, it mashes it all up together and it's maybe a bit too much, but I think it's got some wonderful, quite evocative ideas that sort of suggest that Millennium is in this lawless place, and that if it was going to carry on to series, Frank's whole journey would be now trying to understand this world, understand what this world is, and how he fits in that, and how he can be a good man in this sort of lawless, terrifying new America, I suppose, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, like, again, you singled out the art there, and like, on these issues, these seven issues, both Immaculate and this, again, the artwork by Colin Lorimer is fantastic. It's really atmospheric, it's really good. It's not obsessed with likeness, which is great in a licensed comic. Like, it's actually more obsessed with mood and capturing atmosphere. And, like, again, things like the inking and the colours are very striking as well. And the way in which Frank's visions are frequently... The way in which the panel layout makes Frank's visions overwhelming, because like they tend to be bigger and then you have smaller panels within them that are like his reaction to them, as if to say, look, he's actually physically overwhelmed. This is how powerful and how striking they are, which is again, because Millennium was a show designed for television, those visions were designed for television. They're cut quickly, they're very intricate, they're very stressful, they're very loud, they're in your face, you don't even realize you've seen them. You can't replicate that on a comic page. So I like that Lorimer kind of does something different, where it's like, no, instead I make them big and bold and provocative, and I dwarf the characters within them. So you have things like, say, Jordan drowning and saying, Daddy, please help me, in red, and then you have a tiny panel of Frank looking at Mulder saying, no, I'm okay, I know what's happening, as if to like, and again, really good visual storytelling. And to single out Harris's writing, like, I read this and I read a lot of this in Lance Henriksen's voice. It's very easy to imagine Henriksen reading this dialogue, which is quite impressive, because Frank Black has a very distinctive voice, one that's very distinct from Mulder and Scully, and it's kind of fun to imagine that. I think, like, again, it's like, when you're reading something like this and you can hear an actor's voice in your head, I think it's a sign that, yeah, Harris kind of has that aspect of it, at least. I do think there's far, far too much going on. But again, you kind of understand that in the sense of, well, it's five issues, and also I've got to deal with, you know, three very different shows that just happen to be called one same thing and share a couple of protagonists, you know?
Would this satisfy Millennium fans, though? I mean, if we try and look at it from an audience reaction, I mean, imagine if this was filmed, for one thing. I mean, or a variant of this was filmed. Like I say, it couldn't be done in exactly the same way. But is this the kind of conclusion or reboot, revival, if you like, that that fans would want? Would they want all of this thrown, or do you think it would be something that would be a little bit more, you know, measured and evocative? Because it feels to me like that in this day and age, the expectation on something like Millennium would be to do something quite big and broad in this context, you know, whereas it wouldn't necessarily have been the same 20 odd years ago.
Yeah, like, again, part of me suspects, like, if you wanted to revive Millennium, the thing that you would do is you would start going back to basics and then build outwards. Something very similar to, like, what Russell T. Davies did with Doctor Who, where he started with, like, a season that was just the pared-down essence and had very little mythology. It was literally the only things carried over were the Doctor, the TARDIS, and the Daleks, and then kind of build outwards, whereas this is like, no, from the start, you've got the Daughter, you've got Lucy Butler, you've got Legion, you've got the Millennium Group, you've got the Yellow House... Like, at one point, Frank takes his old, like, red Jeep as well. And it's like, this feels like it's too much. And, like, that's the push and pull for me, where it's like, I can understand trying to cram all of that in if you're trying to wrap a bow up and say, look, this is one ending for Millennium. I know the fans are still going to write, you know, fan fiction, fan scripts. I know that, you know, we may even get, like, fan-produced films or whatever down the line, but this is one ending for Millennium. But part of me feels like you don't really get away with that when it's also very clearly, and I think Harris has said in interviews that he was trying to gauge the temperature for the possibility of Millennium Revival. So it feels like it's trying to have its cake and eat it in that regard, in that I feel like if you were launching Millennium, it would be better to start with something smaller and less mythocentric. And to be fair, again, the fact that this is a comic book and comic books tend to aim towards a smaller, more targeted audience of hardcore fans means you can get away with it. So I can't imagine anything with like a larger mass media appeal, like a television miniseries or a feature film, like going as hardcore as this does immediately. And I think that would probably be for the best. Like, I think if you were to bring it back, if you were to bring Frank Black back, you'd probably want to start broad. I mean, like, again, I think I've talked about this on The Time Is Now quite a bit. One of the things, and I know this is one of the things where Darren alienates half of the Millennium fan base, I quite like that the Legion mythology isn't really a mythology, in that, like, it's just vague and broad and ambiguous, and you can't really piece it together, and it doesn't really make sense, because that makes it feel, like, tangibly alien and distinct from the conspiracy theory of the X-Files, where the X-Files, you have, like, aliens, and you have an alternate history, and you have, you know, I mean, I know, admittedly, you have things like, say, Biogenesis, and, like, Amor Fati, and the Sixth Extinction, and stuff like that, where it's like, oh, by the way, the aliens are also God. But, like, generally speaking, on the X-Files, it's like there's a conspiracy, you know, we can track it down to Roswell, New Mexico, you know, 1972, all these key dates, and colonization is going to happen in 2012, and it's just going to line up perfectly. Whereas, like, with Millennium, I like that Legion is like, what? No, it's hard to determine what this thing wants. It's hard to determine when this thing is acting, and, like, whether Lucy Butler is her own entity or just one face of it, or whether or not the deal that's extended to Frank in The Judge is meant to be similar to the one that's extended in The Curse of Frank Black. And I like that unknowability. And I feel like when you get resolutions, or when you get stories like this to try and wrap it up, it feels like it makes it kind of smaller and kind of less compelling than it was on television, because it tries to explain or kind of outline or to make sense of it all. And I like the fact that it didn't make sense almost, you know?
Yeah, it is a bit more explicit, isn't it? About, oh, you know, Legion is this, and this is, you know, yeah, there is a bit more of that. And I think, yeah, it may be, there are certain things that were you know, enjoyably left to the imagination with all that, that, yeah, are a bit more on the nose. And to be fair, there is no way in any Millennium revival we would have a scene where Mulder has a phone conversation with Geebs. Like, that would... I'm just gutted. I mean, I love the fact we got a reference to Geebs, but we didn't see Geebs. Like, there was no... It's just, why would you not show Geebs? Captain Giebelhaus, you know, as he is now.
Well, that's exactly what would happen on a TV show, because, like, the actor playing Giebelhaus might be retired now, and he might not want to come back, or he might not, like, he might not be in the budget to come back. So how you reference him is you have, like, David Duchovny on a cell phone saying, thank you, Captain Giebelhaus, and hanging up, and it's like, there's the reference. Whereas in comic books, you don't have those budget constraints. You could, like, give us a panel of saying, nah, I don't know nothing anyhow. I thought this case was simply millenniumistic.
Yeah, exactly. Just that, if there's one big missed opportunity, I mean, Emma Hollis is one. I think this is the other one, absolutely.
A single panel of Giebelhaus, like, in the Seattle police. Like, it just needs to be one panel. He could just be on the phone, like, with his feet up on the desk, just saying something Giebelhaus-y. I love that I'm like, is there too much fan service? And now we circle back around to, but not the fan service I want.
No. Not as. Yeah, not we want Giebs. Yeah, hashtag we want Giebs. But yeah, let's finish up then, because we do have a little bit of fan feedback, actually listener feedback from the Yellow House, the Millennium Podcast fan group on Facebook. So yeah, this is what some other people have thought about these two sort of issues. So Michael Little says, I thought they were pretty bad. I wanted to love them, but I just didn't like the writing. Fair enough. I think, you know, Harris, he's a little bit like Chris Carter in the fact he's quite florid at times and things like that. And I think his writing might be a bit of a, you know, depending on what you're into, I guess. But, fair enough.
No, I mean, to be fair, like, if you've listened to episodes on the mythology episodes, I think I get on board with that. I hope future Darren is entirely consistent with current Darren.
I am confident he will be, don't worry. Joe Contour says, I wasn't a reader of the X-Files comic series, but I picked those two issues because I knew what was coming. I thought it was a good little supernatural horror story that basically served as a reintroduction to Frank Black. I mostly liked the Millennium comic series. Nice setup that didn't stick the landing. I remember enjoying it as I was going along, but being disappointed in that last issue. I really hope this isn't the final word on Frank Black, though. After the end of the TV series, when we pick back up with Frank in that X-Files episode, he's not looking as good as when he ran off with Jordan at the end of Goodbye to All That. That's very true. now we pick up with Frank in these comics, and he's somehow in even worse shape. He's a complete recluse with zero communication with adult Jordan. I mean, how much lower can the guy sink at this point? I get the if you stare into the abyss stares back trope, but give the guy a break.
That's the nature of, like, bringing back characters who have endings. Like, that's the nature of kind of resurrecting characters. It's like, if a character has an ending and they're fully satisfied, there's no narrative reason to bring them back at all. So, like, the moment that anybody decides to write a Frank Black story, Frank Black is doomed to suffer horribly as a result, because he's never going to get, like, he'll get to the end and he'll be happy, but the fact that you will continue, like, this is something that I think people don't get when they complain about things like, say, the Star Wars sequels, where they're like, yeah, but those sequels, man, they ruin the happy ending of Return of the Jedi. And it's like, yes, any story that you tell after Return of the Jedi ruins the happy ending of Return of the Jedi, unless it's like Han and Leia went to a picnic and it was really nice. Because, like, stories demand that things happen to characters, and characters have to want things, and characters have to have, like, motivation. And so, like, and because Frank Black is the character he is with the gravity that he is, it inevitably has to be something terrible. So I get that. Like, I understand that. But part of me is like, part of me is wondering, like, if the character, like, you know, I have my issues with Goodbye to All That, but part of me is like, but, you know, maybe if Frank Black had just been left there, like, he would have been happier as a fictional character. Yeah. I know, but still.
And at least the Millennium episode in season 7 allows him to go off with Jordan and seemingly be quite happy even after all that. So, you know, it sort of gives him happy ending number 2. You know, whereas this, it's just misery.
But again, like, that part of that's because it feels like it's a launching pad. It feels like it's setting up a status quo that you can run with, so to speak, but not run away with your daughter with.
Yeah, exactly. Michael John Petty, who's obviously been on The Time Is Now before, says, I really love them. I'm a big fan of the season 10-11 comics in general. I preferred the focus on properly finishing out the mythology that the actual seasons 10-11 didn't give us. Oh, that's a whole big conversation we may have already had. And so when future versions of us, Darren, will know if we've had that conversation, but I suspect we have. And so in Frank Black, my favourite character outside of Mulder and Scully themselves, Return for Immaculate, I was really excited. Although I like that story a lot, I'm a bigger fan of the Millennium miniseries, though I thought it was too short. The strain on Frank and Jordan's relationship due to a gift and the group itself made a lot of sense and was an interesting concept worth exploring. The addition of Mulder to the story was also a welcome one, as it allowed him to represent us as the outsider to the conflict. The return of the demon Lucy Butler was also welcomed. However, I felt that because the series limited run, there was no real conclusion. There we go. And I'm left feeling the same way about Frank and his story that we were at the end of the X-Files crossover. Ultimately, although I'm a big fan of Frank's return in Joe Harris's run, it serves as a reminder that we probably won't ever see Frank Black return to television, and that's a harder pill to swallow. I mean, will we? I mean, I suppose that's a question to ask you off the back of that. Will we see Frank again? I mean, I even despite Lance Henriksen getting up there in age, he's still keen to do it, it seems. So, you know, would it ever happen, though? I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, again, like, you know, you had the X-Files revival, and that did very well in its first season and less well in its second season, which would seem to have, like, put a dampener on it. I know we're hearing stories about, like, you know, animated shows and kind of, like, comedy spin-offs and stuff like that. But it really, I don't see Disney being particularly interested in Millennium as a potential franchise extension, which is a real shame. And again, like, part of me is, like, you can tell because they haven't even, like, remastered it for HD. Like, if that would be the first sign that they were at all interested in it, because they did it with the, you know, Fox did it with the X-Files, and Disney presumably have an entire teams that are dedicated to upscaling and preserving stuff. So, like, if they were preserving Millennium, part of me would be like, maybe there's a chance. But yeah, I can't. I mean, I'm surprised that we haven't, like, seen more fan stuff with Lance Henriksen involved. I know that it's a thorny legal area, particularly after those feckings. Sorry, I should be more neutral about it after the whole Battle of Axanarth situation, which may be seen as a bunch of fans who pushed their weight and basically killed the fan film industry in its form as it existed up to that point. I don't even see that working, which is a shame.
No, I know. I think it would have been released on Blu-ray for starters over time, especially now, and it never has been. And It's not even been
it's not
put
even on
to
Star,
Star,
right? In the UK and Ireland,
in the UK. It's not on any streaming service in the US either, and it's just, it really is in danger of becoming one of those lost TV shows. So, yeah, I'm dubious too, but, you know, we live in hope. We live in hope. Philip A. Moore said, I love that series, but it frustrates me we did not get more. It's not a pun on his name, I don't think, but, you know, it works both ways. And Christian Ponce says, I love Joe Harris's scripts, but both crossovers left me a bit confused. I didn't read them again anyway after reviewing All of Millennium last year. Maybe I should. Maybe you should, Christian. Because I think they're good stories. You know, they're not... I would probably agree with you, Darren, that Immaculate's the better story of the two. I think the better piece of work, generally, of the two. But I think they're both really worth reading. And I think if you're a fan of Millennium... And obviously a fan of The X-Files, but if you're particularly a fan of Millennium, I think you really, really will enjoy it, you know, or you'll enjoy certain aspects of it. You know, I think this it is one for completists, I guess, but, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a completist.
Yeah, you're listening to a podcast about a comic book about an X-Files spin-off sibling show that was cancelled after three seasons and is not available on DVD at the moment. I think it's safe to say you're probably a completionist, and we are too, and we love you very much for that.
Absolutely,
Like, I will say, like, I read them again. I don't regret them. I mean, I like, for me, the Stefan Petrucca X-Files run, the original Topps comic run, is one of the best tie-in comics ever written. And it's, like, it's unimpeachable. It is, for me, like, the ideal tie-in comic book. I don't think of Harris's work quite as highly, but I do consider it better than a lot of the stuff that followed Petrucca's kind of, like, Topps run. And I think, like, I think it does interesting things, and I think it, you know, it's very readable, and it's clearly written with a lot of affection, a lot of understanding of the material as well. So, like, I mean, you know, even if I don't think they're the greatest things since sliced bread, I'm glad that they're there, and I really enjoyed reading them, and I really enjoyed going back and reading them to talk about them with you, actually.
Yeah, me too. It's been a while since I've read the Immaculate particularly, and it's I'm looking forward to going through them / I've been enjoying going through them. this is to cover both bases in both time zones. So, yeah, it's...
I'm really looking forward to seeing who you have on next week to talk about, you know, was it Monica and John, isn't it?
Monica and John. Yeah. I mean, you know, my future me knows. Current me, no idea. But we'll see. Could be you, Darren. Maybe it's you.
It's probably me. Quick side further. I will note that, like... We talked about, like, the comic bookness of it. I do love that in Monica and John you have a little, like, classic Marvel or DC asterisk box where they're like, by the way, if you want to find out what Mulder's up to at the moment in the middle of this story, check out Millennium IDW number 1 on sale now. And I love that. I love comic books so much. I'm a big comic book nerd.
It's great, isn't it? I just wish we had a whole Carterverse, you know, in comics. I would love it.
Like Harsh
I'd bring
Realm.
It on. Yeah, put them all together. But, you know, maybe. If the X-Files ever gets a big reboot, maybe we'll get that one day. Who knows?
Into the Carterverse. I like that.
Into the Carterverse, yeah. Well, Darren, it's been a pleasure, as it always is, recording with you about this and discussing it. And I hope people have enjoyed our conversation. So thank you so much for coming on and talking some X-Files and Millennium with me. So let's have a fun little game. Why don't you tell us, for the listeners of The Time Is Now who will have listened to this, you know, more in the present day, why don't you tell us what you're up to? But then for listeners in the future, why don't you tell them what you think you will be up to?
All right.
This will be fun.
This will be very fun. So listeners listening to The Time Is Now in real time, you can find me online. I'm at Darren_Mooney on Twitter. I'm right at The Escapist, where I write a couple of weekly columns. I do some online video work on their YouTube channel. I'm very proud of that. It's really, really great. I also do a podcast, The 250, my good friend Andrew Quinn. We've had Tony on before, and we're hoping to have Tony on later for what we're calling an Indiana summer. It's like an Indian summer. Yeah. It's like Indiana summer, where we'll be talking about the Indiana Jones movie. So I'm trying to organize those. Those will hopefully be coming up in August. But we have a wonderful slate ahead of you. So if you are listening to the X-Cast in the distant future, like, I don't even know when this is going out. So
no,
this is fantastic.
Me neither. We'll see.
So I will hopefully have finally finished my fourth book, which is a study of fandom and fan culture. And that will hopefully be coming from Macfarlane Press at some point in the near future. I will also, my other two books will be available as well. So things like I've written about the X-Files, that will be available, Opening the X-Files from Macfarlane Press. Christopher Nolan Critical Study of the Films is also out there.
Cool. Awesome stuff. I am very excited for the projects in the immediate and the far future from Darren. That's going to be brilliant. And you can find me and what I'm up to at AJ Black Writer and the broader website we made this network.com. So check us out and what we're up to on there. But we'll be back soon for either more Millennium conversation or more IDW and X-Files chat. So thanks for joining us for another episode. Remember, we're part of the We Made This Podcast Network, and Millennium / the X-Files is not all we're discussing, so we'll give you a little taste of what you might have missed on the network in a minute. We'll see you next time, but remember, as always, either trust no one, or this is who we are, or trust no one that this is who we are.
I like that last one. This is who we trust no one. This is who we trust no one.
No one. Yeah, that's the one. That's the one. That's the one.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
The Giddy Carousel of Pop.
We find ourselves in the Hammersmith Odeon with Dave Rimmer. He's backstage, deep in the murky bowels of the Odeon. All is not well, writes Dave. Somebody has got the Gap Band's trousers mixed up in their dressing room. Charlie, one of the three Wilson brothers, who are the nucleus of the Gaps, holds up a silvery sequin pair of strides that no sane human being would be seen dead in. These aren't my shingles, he exclaims disgustedly. These are Robert's. He throws them down.
It's the fact that they call them the missing Baco foil kecks.
That's what really made me laugh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And spangly combat gear. So there's a kind of, yeah, the fashion correspondent is working overtime.
We Buy Records.
We're now officially in the sunlit uplands of post-Brexit sovereign Britain. So we thought it might be fun to sort of take a tour around those sunlit uplands of post-Brexit sovereign Britain and see how that relates to buying and selling records. Because it's going to be good, right? They had what? They had four years to sort of figure it out.
Let's stay positive and hope that all of the emails we've had on the subject are positive, shall we?
We dig music.
The Instrumentals album, they almost do work as meditations. It's more music that I can add to my sad yoga core genre.
I tell you what, right? I messaged Colin about this earlier because this is the first time I got to the Instrumentals. But considering you hate noodly nonsense, this is noodly f***ing nonsense. Like, how long is that first track?
The thing is, they were improvised tracks.
You can tell.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying that in a negative way, because she's a fantastic player. Mm. But if you were to look up self-indulgent in a dictionary, this would be one of the pictures.
Yeah, we've both picked up on this. You are never, ever, ever, ever allowed to complain about something being noodly again.
Okay,
nope.
I promise.
Because this is the definition of it. And it's great. We like noodly stuff.
Yeah.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This Podcast Network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod, or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.